Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and broadcast on Delmarva Public Radio, WSDL 90.7 FM. We're about to have a conversation with Michael Twitty. Mike Twitty, of course, culinary historian of African and African-American foodways and blogger at Afroculinaria, among many other things he does in the world of food and thinking and life. And Michael Twitty, welcome. Good to have you back.
Well, I'm so glad to be back, Mark.
So let's talk a bit about what you were talking with Mark Ernie, one of our producers, about earlier in the week, just your initial reflections on the uprisings that took place around Freddie Gray's death and the idea of food and food scarcity in deserts, how they're connected for you.
Well, you know, the first thing I thought about was the Save-A-Lot. The Save-A-Lot was getting looted, and I'm like, what for? What, you know, I've been to that Save-A-Lot several times. Not the greatest, you know, not the greatest spot in the world, you know, no disrespect to Save-A-Lot, but my God, you know, you only have so much produce. The rest of the food is processed. The only cheese I ever saw in the place was called government-issued cheese product. I mean, you think about that and say, what are you stealing? Potato chips? And maybe that's the problem, you know? I'm not talking about, you know, having a gourmet kind of, like, war here. But, I mean, if you think about the juxtaposition of that versus, you know, the Whole Foods in the area supplying food to the law enforcement. That's a dramatic picture right there. Just those two images. People scrambling over what little they have versus the most expensive grocery chain saying there's law enforcement here. Thanks for doing a good job. It really is bizarre.
It is an interesting juxtaposition. I think that, you know, I mean, what things symbolize the kind of wealth of eating healthy and supporting those who are being charged with controlling people who are angry about being communities that don't eat healthy, and they're looting out whatever food it had that existed in that community.
Right. And you don't have any, and this is an age-old problem. Here's my issue. You know, you introduced me as a food historian, culinary historian.
Right.
Back in the colonial antebellum period and federal periods of Baltimore, black people controlled the food market. Okay, in Baltimore.
What does that mean? Describe what that means.
They basically had an economic monopoly over it. They were the poultry producers. They raised the chickens on the farms, the plantations surrounding Baltimore and other parts of Maryland. They grew truck patches. They grew gardens where they're providing the produce. There were certain kinds of produce that were unique to the black community. Only the black community produced. We've talked about the fish pepper. We've talked about the okra. We've talked about that stuff on the show before. And when the Haitians come in, Haitian refugees come in, they actually marry into the African-American community in Baltimore, and they have a monopoly for 20 years over that market until the laws are changed to disenfranchise black participation in the selling of food, fish, shellfish from the bay, et cetera. So think about this. 200 some years ago, black people ran the show when it came to food in the city of Baltimore. What does that say? And they probably ate much better than the average black Baltimorean does today.
I mean, that's reflect on that a minute, what you were just saying. I mean, first of all, because some people will posit all the time that black folks never controlled anything and never controlled food in particular in this slave society. But you're setting up a different historical world for us to wrestle with. The fact that that free black people and married Haitians who fled and came here really ran the food market and selling system in the city.
Mm-hmm. And did so. And when people were enslaved in the city, they demanded to have a garden patch. They demanded to have an area for their chickens. They were selling this stuff because this was one of the largest cities in America. And at one point, Baltimore had the largest food market in America. So you're thinking about this and going, wow, so what's the change? What's the factor? What's going on here? But also considering the fact that that's alongside Baltimore being this, for all intents and purposes, a geographic jail for black people. The minute you stepped outside the city of Baltimore, you know, you were no longer, you're no longer safe. You're no longer free.
So
you could be captured any second. And so there's this idea that Baltimore has been both this haven for black people and also kind of like a prison as well.
Mm-hmm.
But even in that, we made our own way.
So if you take that to the 21st century, what do you do with that information? What do you do with that history about, in terms of analysis of where we are now and where we could take ourselves?
Well, you know, I think Denzel and other people across the urban landscape have proven that community gardens, that community farm projects, urban farming, improve the way people look at their neighborhoods, interact with their communities, interact with each other, interact with their food. There's all that space there. Detroit's doing it. Detroit is taking back vacant land and vacant spaces and turning them into food spaces and foodscapes. Baltimore has to do the same thing. Black Baltimore specifically has to do the same thing. It's an issue of power. It's an issue of ownership, and it's also an issue of, you know, channeling energies into certain projects. I mean, we're talking about, you know, our esteemed governor, you know, doesn't want money for schools, but he wants money for a new prison. Well, that prison is being planned on the gamble that all those young people are the next crop for the new Jim Crow. So I say use food and use food empowerment to wage the ultimate war. The ultimate war is not between black and white. The ultimate war here is between those that want to imprison people of color and keep the cycle going and those that want to break the cycle permanently and destroy the prison industrial complex. And you know, what I've said before about gardening and food is this. When you give our children access to this, you're teaching them science, you're informing their literacy, teaching them math, you're teaching them about nutrition, teaching them about their heritage, their history, you're connecting them with the past generations, you're connecting with each other, connecting with their community, with the land. If you don't have that, if you don't feel that, then burning down a building is nothing to you.
So part of it is a number of levels, but before we have to leave each other, I mean, one of the levels is to talk about how you take that knowledge, that energy, and transform it. If you take it from the community side out, bottom up rather than top down, about the ability to control your community and control the food within it, is a possibility.
Absolutely. And one of the most important things is the ability to market. That's what made the community in the antebellum period so strong. They marketed their food.
Mm-hmm.
This was an entrepreneurial endeavor. And when food is hot now, people in this area and other areas of the East Coast, they want to look at what does my greater urban area have to offer in terms of locality. This is a ripe opportunity for these young people to, you know, market things that are valuable and create a viable economic path for themselves. This is not a bootstraps philosophy. This is just simply, you know, this is our territory. This is our lane. This has always been our lane. And we need to get back in it. And we take over it. Because there's nothing wrong about putting your fingers in the dirt. That's one of the things that we have to do, Marcus. We have to tell people, no, you're not going backwards by reconnecting with the earth. You're not going backwards by putting your fingers in the dirt. You're not being a slave. You're going forward. You're preserving our planet. You're preserving our people. And you're preserving our destiny. And you're destroying those prisons. And that's the ultimate message we have to give.
And so that's a critical message you're giving here, because you're talking about not just farming for subsistence, farming to feed a community, farming for feeding a community, but also the idea that you can build a system in black communities that can sell food to everybody, to own a market.
Right?
Right.
Right. So you know something? I'm going to tell you something amazing. I was in Atlanta in 2012 during the first leg of my project, and I saw something that made me feel so proud and stunned me. I had never seen a dollar travel in the black community and stay there. So I went to a market, a small community farmers market in southwest Atlanta, and there was a gentleman there from Montezuma, Georgia, who brought up his produce. He sold the produce to a lovely sister there who was a vegan caterer. The very next day, she transformed their produce into food at a fundraiser benefit for the Hopsha, the organization that does urban farming and gardening with kids, and takes them to Africa and trains them and does all sorts of wonderful things. And here it was. I saw the dollar travel from the resources travel from the farmer to the caterer to me buy her food, and part of that money goes back to supporting the community. And I thought, this is a miracle. This is what I've always wanted to see.
Hmm.
And it was like stunning. I thought to myself, I've never seen this before. I've never seen this before. And it was all centered around food.
And something that you know that you believe that can be replicated on a much larger scale.
Oh, absolutely. There's no reason it can't. There's no reason why we can't do it. We simply have to put in the work. And the work has to be absolutely communal. And has to go to every single level. You know, whatever easements we can create so that people can do this, it'll have, you know, bureaucratic barriers to transforming the landscape around them. We need to work on that first. And then after that, think about, okay, so what's in the soil? Is the soil clean? Is it not? If it's not clean, we got to build above it. But we got to do something. We can't have just weeds and rocks and rubble. we can't do that anymore. You know, I've seen the outskirts of the West Bank and Gaza. Baltimore shouldn't have to be like that. We use the term uprising. It's interesting how that term applies. The term applies there and it applies here. Well, people uprise when they don't have the basic needs met. You and I are both Jews. There's an old saying, where there's no bread, there's no Torah.
Right.
We both know what that means. Where there's no basic subsistence and basic needs are not being met, all the rest of it is for naught.
Exactly. Michael Twitty, you always bring these gems of beautiful wisdom to us, and I think it's something we need to wrestle with, the idea of having these cooperatives and building a new society, and it can come from the bottom up. And I deeply appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule and all the stuff you're working on to be with us here today and doing this. Michael Twitty is culinary historian of African-American Foodways, blogger at Afroculinaria, and looking forward to his book that will be coming to us sometime in the near future. Michael Twitty, brother, thank you so much for your thoughts
thank
and wisdom.
You so much.
Thank
this
you. We're about to talk to three young farmers, and we've been talking about the uprising that occurred around the death of Freddie Gray and how food scarcity and the issues of food in communities affect people's lives, how that's part of the healing process and the feeding process and more, and where that might take us. And so we're joined here by Walker Marsh, founder and owner of The Flower Factory. He's back in the studio again. Good to have you here, Walker.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure.
Sasha Jones is with us, food justice consultant for the Park Heights Community Health Alliance, and she manages the Afya Teaching Garden in Park Heights.
Thank you.
Good to have you back. And also back with us is Blaine Snipstall, who is a returning generation farmer on the Eastern Shore at his farm, Black Dirt Farm. And Blaine, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me again, Mark.
So let me just jump right into it. When Michael Twitty originally threw this out to us, this idea that you know, that the idea of food deserts and food scarcity plays an effect, affects people's minds and how they think and the behavior and their thoughts and their souls, and how that might have fed into what happened in the community after we learned of Freddie Gray's death. I'm curious just how you all would analyze and feel about that. Yeah. Sasha, why don't we start with you? Do you mind?
No. I think it's interesting, especially where I am in Park Heights, because typically, the neighborhood at its prime, was not an African-American neighborhood. And so when I talk to elders in my community or who have lived there in the past, they speak of a time where you could walk down the street and your neighbors had fruit trees and, you know, this neighbor over here had a garden and, you know, there was a butcher shop and a flower shop and, you know, all these things within the community that completely went against what it looks like now, where it's just a picture of scarcity and kind of blight. But then at the same time, looking at the, like, overall history of African-American neighborhoods, you know, the historic ones. So we can point to, you know, our Cherry Hills. We can point to our Sandtown, Winchesters. We can point to those neighborhoods. And I think that the idea of food scarcity or food injustices is not new. And it's something that has existed, you know, for decades. And we were actually just having this conversation in the office of how, you know, it's a branding thing these days where, like, it's being branded food deserts and food justice is a buzzword and it's cool to talk about it now, mm-hmm. but that these issues have always existed. But what has not always existed is this this feeling of disorganized communities, of, you know, disjointed I would say ancestral networks. So, like, you know, not talking to your elders, not mm-hmm. having that those networks in place, and not having your own sovereignty or your own solidarity either within your community or not having it within your own family. And so, how I started is saying that it's complex is that Park Heights in its prime, you know, when it was really a food oasis, you can walk by and see food everywhere. You can see, you know, place to buy it or grow it or whatever. That's a picture of where we would like to go, you know, in all of the neighborhoods in Baltimore, and understanding that this issue is not new, but the biggest part of it is our understanding that the government won't change it. And, you know, city policy will never do enough to actually permeate to the neighborhood level. And it's not really supposed to. It's supposed to give you the opportunity to do it. And then you at the community level take ownership of that and you make use of whatever program or policy is on the board right now. And so, you know, at our garden, at FIA Community Teaching Garden, that's where our conversation is. So bringing back food sovereignty, bringing back the knowledge, using the knowledge of the elders and the curiosity of the youth and the get it doneness of the middle aged, you know, all together, mm-hmm. you know, to really create a system where we do have control over our food to whatever extent we can, whether we're growing it ourselves, you know, through our garden, our CSA, which is called the Growing Food Together CSA, or, you know, whether you're buying it locally, you know, from a farmer's market, which we have the Park Heights Community Farmers Market, you know, or you're buying it from a farmer that's not at the market. So connecting you to farmers like Walker, you know, who's selling flowers, or like Blaine, you know, on the Eastern Shore that, you know, sells all this stuff. So understanding the network that we already have and tapping back into it ourselves. That makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Blaine, why don't you pick up on that, Blaine? Or on your own way of approaching that.
Right. Well, I just want to give thanks again for having this opportunity to share with you. And I also want to mention I'm not from Baltimore. In fact, I lived inside the city very briefly last year, but I've always been camped on the outside or the periphery, the rural areas surrounding Baltimore and the mm-hmm. DMV area. So just to give that clarification. But, you know, Sasha alluded to some really poignant points, and I think one thing to help give us a greater understanding about the political context of these, not just of these uprisings, but the dynamics of the food system, right, is that historically, as people of color, as of black people, you know, we were used to build a food system that was never designed for us. So today, the repercussions or the evolution of this food system that came from the South, you know, that manifested now throughout cities, is doing exactly what it has historically been designed to do, which is first and foremost to generate profit mm-hmm. and not to feed people, but also to create what are called sort of insular economic zones, where if you're not on the inside, you're left out or you don't have it, you know? And so I think when we think about food sovereignty within that context, there's another recognition that Sasha alluded to, whereas we have to have these connections between the rural and urban areas. And amongst the young folks within the city and surrounding Baltimore City, we're actually quite connected. We actually had a gathering out at our house on the Eastern Shore several weeks ago, or I guess several months ago now. But to, you know, to form these personal relationships that inform political and professional relationships. And so that's so fundamental because the research has said, and even, you know, we've seen examples in other parts of the country that urban agriculture cannot feed cities. It's just not, first of all, the land that would be required within a city to do that is very high. And most cities don't have that type of land base, although Baltimore is unique, much like Detroit and some of the northern post-industrial cities. Mm-hmm. And so that requires or necessitates a relationship with the rural area. And not just in a production relationship in terms of, i.e., Black Dirt Farm giving sweet potatoes or tomatoes to Sasha or, you know, whatever it may be to Walker and whoever else, of which we do, but also the training to receive the knowledge and the technical aspects to how to produce food in an ecological way that's in harmony with the planet. Mm-hmm. Because the food system as it stands now always has contradictions, right? And those contradictions are always hidden by two main things: the political context of the food system and petroleum. And so once both of those become unstable, then the contradictions of the food system, which are highly unequal distribution of power and wealth and control, unequal distribution of food, unequal distribution of poor foods in particular neighborhoods, all of these things get unraveled once the political and the petroleum or energy context, you know, hit a crisis, which they're hitting now. And so that gives us an opportunity, much like this conversation, to begin to articulate, well, how do we begin to actually feed ourselves, not just in physical terms, in terms of food or production, but also in terms of networks, so, you know, building our own internal solidarity economies and so mm-hmm. on and so forth. And these are very pragmatic things that we've seen take place in other parts of the world, in Cuba, in Zimbabwe, in Mozambique, in Brazil. You know, we have these examples of when these crises have hit and how people have addressed it. And the last thing I'll say, again, that Sasha alluded to as well, is that it cannot be done without the state. But the state or the municipality or the city cannot do it. It has to be an organization of the peoples. And so one thing that we have historically struggled with, we being all people, but particularly Black people, people of color, is maintaining, you know, autonomous organizations that actually put forth the work. And not in the saying that we are not able to put forth the work, but oftentimes when we begin to put forth the work, we are under threat because our work fundamentally confronts a social system and political and economic system that's designed to thwart our efforts in terms of building our power. And in us building power, we build power for everybody and with everybody. I mean, that's the nature of it. So these types of considerations are fundamental, and food allows us to begin to construct a framework and a model of development in which the people are at the center, and the way we want to move forward is collectively defined.
What was you gonna say about that, Walker?
Yeah, that man, following Sasha and Blaine, these guys like really they helped me out so much. I really look up to them both a lot, and just like interning in this world of agriculture. But I totally agree with both of them. I mean, it's so, you know, this food sovereignty, food justice thing is completely, to me, it's the Black experience of America. I mean, this is stuff that's been going on since forever, since we've been in this country. And for me, you know, because I was out there at the protests, just like, you know, probably, you know, Sasha and them, they've been out there doing that, the whole Freddie Gray situation. And just to know that area, because, you know, I'm from Baltimore. I grew up mostly in the county. But, you know, it's to know that area and to know that there really isn't much over there. It's not like a lot of opportunities are on that side of town. And, you know, that really kind of led to a lot of those situations where police are harassing people. Because I actually talked to the guy that they called him, he knew Freddie Gray personally, and he was an older gentleman. I think they called him Uncle something. I can't remember his name is. Mm-hmm. But he was saying that, you know, he's known Freddie, and the police had been harassing him for a while. And, you know, it wasn't his first interaction with the police. So, you know, the lack of opportunities in that neighborhood could have played, you know, well, did play a big role in that. But as far as food sovereignty and food justice goes, you know, I think like how Blaine said, you know, we need to do a lot more training and skills development, because that's what I'm really going for after and with my thing with the Flower Factory, because I think that if we were to simply get a lot of these guys out here and train them and do more skills development, because a lot of people, you know, there was a big push for individuals to go to college and get these degrees and, you know, all these other things. And, you know, we've been seeing that, you know, it hasn't paid off because when it comes to food, you know, and this food access and food inequalities issue, it's not just about actually going out there and getting the food. It's also about actually being able to afford that food, like financially afford it. And a lot of these folks out here cannot even afford the food. And I think that if we had more skills to just train ourselves to even just grow the food so that we could grow it ourselves, or like myself, start a business that is not selling food, but I'm selling flowers, but I'm still using those same skills that I learned in the, you know, doing urban farming. And, you know, if we would have more models of that, maybe more people could go after that, you know, aspect of it.
I'm talking with Sasha Jones, Walker Marsh, and Blaine Stepstall. We're going to take a very brief break. On the way there, it's Gravy from a Mashed Potatoes by D.D. Sharp, recorded on this day in 1962. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and broadcast on Delmarva Public Radio, WSDL 90.7 FM. And that's Maybelline by Chuck Berry, recorded on this day in 1955. And I'm speaking with three young farmers about the Baltimore uprising and how it relates to issues of food sovereignty in Baltimore and beyond. I'm joined by Sasha Jones, food justice consultant for the Park Heights Community Health Alliance and manager of the Afia Community Teaching Garden in Park Heights, Walker Marsh, founder and owner of the Flower Factory, and Blaine Snipstall, returning generation farmer on the Eastern Shore at Black Dirt Farm.
There's a lot of questions I have here. I mean, I'm about where this might take us. I'm thinking about things that all of you have said, and Sasha started this conversation off talking about government won't change, you'd have to take ownership, and Blaine followed up with that idea as well. And so where do we take that? I mean, by that I mean, let me take a step backwards. Now, I heard what you said earlier, Sasha, but I can recall growing up in Baltimore, and there wasn't a food scarcity in deserts in the black world like there is now. There were grocery stores. Mm-hmm. People had gardens in the back of the yards. People still had relationships to the country, whether the country was in Eastern Shore, Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina. People had relationships to the country and to going back home. And, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, that was all there. Yep. And that is gone. In many ways, it's gone. Mm-hmm. And the black farmers in the South losing their land also meant that people going back home, that has shifted in a way. Maybe I'm wrong about this, but like in your generation, younger generations, they weren't sent south in the summer. Like people in my generation, mm-hmm. my friends mm-hmm. were sent back to visit yeah. with their grandmas and aunties and uncles to live for the summer and then come back, you know. So that relationship is gone. So I'm curious your thoughts on how you build on what you're talking about here. What it means to take ownership. From your perspectives, can communities take control of their food? Can they feed themselves or partially feed themselves? How does that dynamic change the nature of a community? Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, mm-hmm. if that was actually a part of what was happening, I mean, what do you see going beyond the places you are now?
Well, exactly what you're saying. So we know what's missing. So we start by, you know, rebuilding those small pieces little by little. And what I mean by that is you're absolutely right. Even in my little short life, I've seen, you know, I have seen the difference between, you know, having the nosy neighbor or the neighborhood auntie or neighborhood mm-hmm. mama, you know, like that's Miss So-and-so, and you call her auntie or grandma or mama, whoever, mm-hmm. you know, seeing how, you know, the culture has kind of shifted in that. And I don't really want to speak to, you know, the the political reasons for why that exists, but what I can say is that we can start by, I mean, introduce yourself to your neighbor. Like, it's as simple as that sometimes, you know. And I ride through my neighborhood in Park Heights all the time and see people with gardens. Get out. When you see someone with a garden, get out and say, oh, hey, what are you doing with those collards, you know? Or how did you get your hydrangeas to look so nice? So that type of thing. But then also, you know, on a wholesale level, like, you know, the organization I work for, the garden that we have is designed, you know, to bring people together, to facilitate those connections. So, like I said, connecting the elders, you know, the knowledge and wise elders to the curious youth, you know, and having the middle-aged of all shapes, sizes, and, you know, colors kind of bridge that gap in between, and using all of those connections to push us forward, because we're not all going to be able to grow the food. You know, we don't all need to grow the food. You know, there's a role in for everyone to bring vibrancy back to the communities. But one, you know, how do we do that is just participate in the systems that are already there. Join your neighborhood association and actually go to the meetings and volunteer. You know, if you shop at your, I was at the Food Justice Committee meeting yesterday, and we were talking about being intentional about shopping at our neighborhood grocery stores. Shop there. If it's bad, complain. Like, use your, right, you know, use your personal sovereignty to push forward change.
But do you think that, do people here think that neighborhoods can be designed where farming and people growing their own food and distributing their own food can actually become an integral part of community? Can, if it doesn't feed everybody, but can it play a larger role than it's playing now? You know, I mean, what you're trying to do in Park Heights with the CSAs that are for working class and poor working class people that nobody else is really trying to do, that's a very different thing. Mm-hmm. Do we think that's actually, is this just a phenomenon of Sasha Blaine and Walker, or you know what I'm saying, or is something that could really take hold, and how would that happen to become the heartbeat of a community if that's possible?
I mean, I think it's definitely possible. I think it's already happening right now. It just takes time. You know, it takes for us to continue to push it and continue to be out there doing this work and promoting it. You know, I just think we just need to continue doing what we're doing and continue to get funding from, you know, the city and state level. And just have people just need to continue to care about this and we have to continue to educate people. I really feel like it comes back to education, and we just continue to do what we're doing because we already doing great things, and it's already moving that way. I mean, I'm just a new addition to this whole movement. I started about 2-3 years ago. And, you know, I've been seeing kids getting more into it, mm-hmm, and more adults getting into it. So it's happening already. It just takes time.
Right. And yeah. I think communities are already organized around food. Like, yeah, communities are, or if they have not, if they are not currently, they have been in the past or should be, you mm-hmm know. And that's not anything new when you look at city states. And, yeah, like, our society is based off of Greek and Roman societies, and they were designed, mm-hmm, you know, the city is designed with where you get your food from. That's definitely not a new concept. But I think as the community is already designed that way, you know, there's already a food network in every community, whether it's disjointed, whether it's nutrient poor, you know, whatever, it's already there. And so, you know, my interest is kind of working with the systems that are already there. So kind of infiltrating, however you phrase it. But it's already designed that way, and it's up to us to just continue to add what we're doing, like Walker said, to continue doing what we're doing, and then taking the time to promote it. Because I think a lot of us get lost in the work and don't spend enough time on communicating and bringing people into the fold. So that's an opportunity for someone else to get involved. If you have the gift of gab and you believe in this, you know, believe in this work, then by all means, join up with someone and start bringing folks in.
So Blaine, you travel the country. You've traveled the country a lot, and you've gone to some of these meetings that have taken place, like the Black Farmers and Urban Growers and those different things. People are doing that kind of work, and I wonder what you think the practicality of that is, the pragmatic aspects of that are in terms of what it can do, what can be built.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a process, and a lot of folks are searching and creating and searching and studying and observing what they're doing and how they can do it better and connect with other folks, and they can exchange information. And so you know, the thing is, it's happening all over the country, and that's actually the most fascinating thing. And I tell folks, like, yeah, like 5 to 7 years, it's about to be off the chain. Watch. Because there are folks all over the country, in rural and in urban areas, but predominantly in urban areas, who are the Sashas, the Denzels, the Walkers, the Aaliyahs, the Melissa Moores, all these folks, and they're everywhere. They're doing amazing things. So there are some barriers that we're seeing, and that aren't just unique to what people are struggling against in Baltimore, and aren't just unique to what people are struggling in New York, and so on and so forth. And that tells us that there's this limit to what we can do individually within cities. And so there are folks who are exploring pragmatically what it would look like to form regional or national Black organization of some sort. Now, the Black Urban Growers is really just a framework to organize conferences, and it hasn't put the jump more beyond that. But to get more to the question that I think that you're really trying to tease out, you know, the struggle is the manifestations of the food movement, as you know, if you will, is largely being fueled by a very robust nonprofit complex that is receiving very large amounts of funding, but those amounts of funding pale in comparison to the funding that goes to the other side of the coin, you know, just to give us that context. And so what we're seeing now is that, okay, well, as people of color, as those in these affected communities, how do we gain direct access to resources to be able to do the work and not have a nonprofit be an intermediary? Because at the end of the day, the nonprofits and the grants are cool, but however, once this moment, this political moment shifts, because it will shift and those resources will go somewhere else, I mean, that's the end, you know, we'll be the ones that are left behind. And so we have to be able to have the infrastructure in place to keep moving forward. And so, you know, the practicality of it fundamentally is, how do we build the social infrastructure in terms of the leadership, the strengthening of community-based organizations, and physical infrastructure? How do we develop urban farms and rural farms, irrigation systems, distribution that can run off of limited petroleum input, access carpenter and welders? You know, all these different things that Sasha and Walker mentioned, that everybody has a role to play. You know, we need to be very conscious about how we are bringing those things beyond word, but actually into action.
So, you know, let's be, I want to play with this just for a minute and go and take this. I've been doing a lot of reading lately and futurist kind of reading, and especially Afrofuturist reading. I've been spending a lot of time with that and thinking about how we can imagine what a place might be and how we build that in our minds, and sometimes that building becomes a reality, right? And I was thinking about what you were saying, Sasha, about almost this ownership and self-reliance, and if this world is actually built that inside of communities, that was controlled by communities and controlling food and more inside of communities, and co-ops and more, what that relationship would mean for the larger structure that runs everything else on the outside.
Yeah.
But how will you envision that? I mean, what in your dreams, in your dreams and fantasies, that to me is the heart and root of all practical futures of dreams and fantasies, right? So at the heart of that, what do you imagine could be? How do you imagine things could be?
I mean, I imagine things could be fair.
I know y'all fantasize about this. I know you do.
Yeah, every day, man, every single day. I think, I mean, for me, I always go back to farming because I'm like, I'm in love with farming. Like, I just love every single moment that I'm out there farming. And I'm like, you know, if we were to take the tools that we have now, like, you know, we got a lot of vacant lots. I'm always thinking about how can we produce more? How can we produce more? That's where I'm always going. It's just like producing more and able to make people have access, like physically access to fruits and vegetables and all these other things. So I'm always thinking about that and just like putting up stuff in this lot or, you know, taking that there, but also having like stores that were, you know, used the produce that we were selling and making it so that people can purchase these things and just, you know, just making it more public instead of just having to carry out here selling, you know, chicken box, you know, maybe some, I don't know, hot dog. I don't know. You know what I'm saying? Just, you know, I don't know. It's we just need to support each other. That's I really feel like that's a big thing. It's just like everybody supporting each other. Like the people that come into the city for the farmers markets don't just support the farmers markets, but they also support other businesses in the city.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
So, Mark, you made me think of my favorite author, of course, Mama Octavia. And
I've been reading Octavia's Brood, all the stories that came. There's an incredible group of short stories in that book that I just love.
Yeah.
Right?
So what comes to mind for me, I hope it does not take a post-apocalyptic world for this to happen, but definitely Parable of the Sower touched me when I read it the first time. And it just shows a community. Again, this is by necessity that there's violence and decay all around them, which doesn't really sound too far off. And so they have transformed their gated community into a full-service, sovereign community. So they have their own fire department. They have their own doctor, their own church, their own school. And I think the thing that touched me the most was the acorn flower. I said they are using the acorns from the tree, you know, and making acorn flour bread, which is gluten-free. So, you know, that's, again, not too far off. I'm sure there's some person somewhere trying to mill acorns right now. So that touched me in the sense that this community was self-sufficient, and they used their collective intellectual power as well as collective manpower to really create a community that worked for, you know, every strata of the community, from the elders down to the babies. Now, I really do not want to live in a world where there are things burning around my community all the time, and I have to, like, fight zombie-like things, you know, to maintain such a perceived oasis of a community.
I had a dream about zombies last night.
See, exactly, because it makes me think, you know, so I would hope that doesn't have to happen. But especially in a place like Baltimore, you know, I was driving down the street just the other day, and I stumbled upon a lot, and it had all this land, and it had a few houses next to it. And so my mind immediately went to, just like Walker said, okay, we're going to put the potatoes over here, we're going to put an orchard over here, we're going to put the greens right here, and then we're going to develop these houses, and then I'm going to live in the first one, and then my hired help, they're going to live in this one, you know. So it's, you know, again, I don't really want all that chaos around me. And at the same time, we live in a perfect place to really start developing these micro communities, you know, because that's what Baltimore is already. It's a city of micro communities and sub-communities and all of these things. And so using that to our advantage and just creating these small little plots of what, you know, of picture of perfection, of, you know, it being food sovereign, but beyond that, you know, using food as an organizing point, you know, so collect go full out Cesar Chavez and start a credit union, you know, have a community office for, you know, water issues, whatever, that type of thing. So
Blaine, take off for a minute.
Right. I'm gonna go back to the acorn.
Okay, cool. Go ahead. Do it. Do it.
Prior to, not even prior to 1492, actually, as soon as, you know, maybe 70 years ago, the indigenous of North America, or Turtle Island, were making acorn mash.
Mm-hmm.
They were already making that. And so I have this teacher named Dr. Awusu Bendeli, and he always says, the only thing new in this world is the history you do not know.
Yep.
And that is couldn't be more true in this conversation, because there is a world that has existed prior to 1492, and there's a world that exists today that I think we have to check in our periphery to bring to the center.
Mm-hmm.
And for that, you know, if we're envisioning the future, you know, a lot of it requires to look back, and not to say we can go back, but you know what? Maybe we need to plant more species of acorns. So we can get to a point where we can yet again return to acorn flour, acorn mash, amongst the other things. They're also making paper and burning materials out of the acorn. So the potential to commune with the planet is so high, but our imaginations have to reach a point to be able to see it. And how Walker and Sasha are articulating about in the city, you know,
that's a perspective that is fundamental to live into the future, to see in the decay, in the destruction, creativity and possibility, to see fire, the phoenix coming out. And so, you know, for me, personally speaking, you know, coming from a rural context, first and foremost, people of color, we fundamentally need to control land. Fundamentally, 96% of land in this country is owned and controlled by whites. And we have to begin to understand how that has come to play and also begin to discuss how we can move back onto land. Not to say there needs to be an exodus from the urban areas, but to seed into people's minds that there are situations like the Denzels who will start in an urban area and something will happen and say, I want to go to a rural side. And we need to have mechanisms that can allow that to happen. Mm-hmm. And so pragmatically for this season, we've been trying to keep it a little under wraps, but I'll mention it now, but we're looking to have an agrarian training program on our farm to connect with some of the folks inside of Baltimore City. Aaliyah's been working with folks in the city, and we're working to develop this immersion program, and we're having folks from the Quilombo and Black Lives Matter community out on the West Coast come out here possibly in July. And so we're looking to have like a 3 to 5 day intensive immersion, not just on agrarian or ecological methods to produce food, but on popular education, on building using bamboo to build structures, mm-hmm. on making biofertilizers, on like, you know, very fundamental accounting systems. You know what I'm saying? So these mm-hmm. you know, holistic ways to develop oneself to be able to contribute positively to the construction of one's community. And so, you know, the thing is like for all of us, we're not often taught the real history, and it's all of our history. You know, we need to know that there were people on the Eastern Seaboard before any of us got here, and they lived in a way that was actually very sustainable for tens of thousands of years. We can't go back to that, but we can talk to them to learn the history and see, okay, well, there's all these trees around, but they have relevance too, and we know how to work with them. And so, you know, there's this symbiosis between us as people and like space in terms of cities and also place in terms of the land. And we have to keep those dynamics in communication. And so, you know, hopefully, Mark, you might get a text, you know, so we could put it out or talk again about this training program.
Absolutely, man. I'd love to do that. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. No question.
Because the folks that are in the conversation, we're very hopeful for what this could represent in terms of a starting point, because this process has been happening for hundreds of years, but yet another piece in it to make these deep connections amongst us as people.
Yeah, I'd like to, as we conclude this part of our conversation today, and we'll come back to it more because there's so much you all have said that we can build on, and also building on what Blaine just said. It was interesting in the wake of the Freddie Gray piece, and it was death, not his piece, in the wake of Freddie Gray's death, mm-hmm. that they saw Whole Foods giving money, giving food to police officers on duty.
Yeah.
And that led to a movement, Denzel and those, and many of you got involved with, mm-hmm. of saying, all right, don't buy from Whole Foods,
yeah.
buy from black farmers. And let's do things. So that was an interesting, to me, juxtaposition of what that moment created mm-hmm. among young people like you. And the response to that was, and that didn't get a lot of play in the press.
Mm-mm.
I don't think
right?
it got in.
But we're going to give it some play now before we go.
I was on Whole Foods' team up until that point. I am the thrift queen. I can spend $20 and come out with, you know, amazing amounts of food. So Whole Foods to me was not one of, every time someone said, oh, Whole Foods is too expensive or Whole Foods is not for me, yada, yada, mm-hmm. yada. You know, I'd say, oh, no, you just got to shop the bulk foods. You know, you got to shop this. You got to know what you're doing. Mm-hmm. But that to me, again, it's just one of those moments. Like Blaine started this conversation, we're experiencing the legacy of a system that wasn't created to serve us, you know. And so Whole Foods, the pinnacle of food, you mm-hmm. know, in the United States, or, you know, where if you want to be a conscious shopper, then you go to this place, you know, and this conscious business, so to speak, is well involved in environmental conversations. They do a lot of help with schools. They give money, you know, to all of mm-hmm. these different things. But when it comes to really being conscious and they're not serving this demographic. So perhaps they didn't even occur to them that that may be looked at as, you know, as a little off. But then again, this community, you know, the when Stop Shop and Save closed, you know, several communities got hit. Park Heights was one, Sandtown, Winchester was another.
Right, right.
You know, and so this community doesn't have a grocery store, and there have been talks about adding Whole Foods throughout the city and, you know, in different ways. And then you have this company come in and pretty much slap you in the face saying, you know, this happened to you and you are upset about it and you're being vocal about it. And now you, you know, are being shut down, you know, on a wholesale level. And we are going to support the people who are shutting you down because you are upset about the decades of oppression in your community that we could help you solve. You know, even though I'm not really a proponent of Whole Foods in the hood, it happened in Detroit and it's not really working that well. So, so you know, it's again, it's complex, but to me...
It might work in the hood if it was called Whole Foods Half Price.
Right.
Yeah. Like, really.
Exactly. So, you know, so, I used to be team Whole Foods. I love their pound cake. Don't judge me. But no, that to me was a real slap in the face. And Whole Foods has a whole campaign to give back to the community, and this was a community that they said just wasn't worth it.
Well, any final? We have about a couple minutes left here. If you wanted,
yeah. I mean, I wasn't really too surprised by the Whole Foods. I mean, like Sasha and Blaine been saying, it's not designed for, you know, black people in America. So for them to actually do something that was like right, you know, I would have been surprised if they actually did the right thing. But you know, it's just how it goes. And but you know, I'm glad that the attention was brought to black farmers and farmers like myself and Blaine and Sasha and Denzel and all the other black farmers in Maryland and outside of Maryland, all across the country. So I just take it in stride, you know, because I've been getting so much attention just from that. There was one article written by Black Novinity, and that thing, it just blew up online. And, like, I mean, people have been, like, trying to get in contact with me and trying to, like, purchase stuff for me. And I'm like, you know, I'm sorry, I don't really have anything right now to sell. But,
right.
You know, I think it's just been great to promote that black ownership and supporting black, you know.
I think that it is, and I think this is. I think that you are right. I think in the next few years, this could explode across the country and across our communities here, but also across America. Well, this has been a great discussion, just beginning of many we're going to have with the folks in this room and folks around people in this room. I just heard Blaine Snipstall, who is returning generation farmer on the Eastern Shore at Black Dirt Farm. Sasha Jones is with us. She manages the Afia Community Teaching Garden in Park Heights. Food justice consultant in the Park Heights Community Health Alliance, and Walker Marsh, founder and owner of the Flower Factory. I want to thank you all so much for being here in the studio for Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites today.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you. The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites are a production of the Center for Emerging Media, made possible in part by a grant from the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer at WEAA is Andre Melton. Our engineer at Public Radio Delmarva is Christopher Rank. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, and find out information from the interviews we are doing on this program, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. You can also listen to and download our podcasts on iTunes. For Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and for WSDL 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.